Hello and welcome to Cider Voice. We're into episode 3, probably, of the new season, and episode 2 of me hosting, which is a record and not one that we're going to look to repeat. I'm joined today by the usual pair of Albert and Justin. And we are continuing our food and cider theme strongly, as a really, really great long friend of mine, Laura, who is owner and runner and baker at an amazing bakery called Beaten by Whisker, is joining us to talk about baking and cider today. So really excited about that. How are you, Laura?
Hello. I'm doing well. Yeah, I've had a long day at the bakery already, but I'm really happy to be here today. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And Albert and Justin, how are you two?
Personally, I'm doing a little bit slower than usual because last night was Whiskey Club at the Yew Tree. And Whiskey Club obviously is also followed by Drink As Much Cider As You Can in a Couple Hours Club. So the two of them in a row slows down your Sunday. But apart from that, I'm wonderful. I'm very excited to talk about deliciousness.
Well, Justin and I have been lucky enough to have several of Albert's bakes in the past. So I think I'm probably the only person in this conversation who has very little to add on the baking front, except as an appreciator. But Laura, let's start off. Tell us about Beaten by Whisker and also your journey to arriving at this wonderful bakery.
We opened 2 years ago. Previously, I had been doing kind of wholesale baking for other cafes. And then during lockdown, a unit in Walthamstow kind of popped up out of nowhere and seemed like the perfect space. So I kind of took the plunge. And decided that to leave wholesale in the past and actually see people enjoying the bakes rather than just sending them off in cars. I just have always wanted to have a bakery, and Beaten by Whisker was the name from the start, and it was originally a kind of recipe blog. I never really imagined that it would be a bakery, but here we are. It's in Walthamstow. It's a vegan bakery, but a lot of our customers aren't vegan, and everybody's very welcome. And hopefully the bakes are good enough to stand apart from its veganism. And we're like a little team now. It started off with just me and one other, but now we're baking way more than I ever thought we would on a daily basis.
Incredible. It's been so great to see you kind of get to the stage where you have your bakery, because obviously I remember when you set up Beaten by a Whisker, the blog, and actually we're two for two on guests in this season who have got fantastic pun game, because we had Fliss in episode 1 with Do Yourself a Flavor recipe book, and now we've got Beaten by a Whisker bakery. So we're just going to have to continue this theme as far as we can.
I just got that. I was just like beaten by a whisker. I know beating. All right, okay. Now, a whisk. Oh my god, mind blown.
Well, maybe it was like you were saying, Justin, to Fliss, that you know maybe she was up going, oh, do yourself a meal, do yourself a recipe. But like the idea that Laura was going through all the different kitchen implements, beaten by a spoon,
beaten by a fork, beaten by a pan. No, none of these work.
But I think the coolest thing about the Beaten by a Whisker origin story is the London Honesty Box. So going back in time a little before we talk more about the bakery itself, can you talk us through that?
Yeah, the Honesty Box was basically an outlet for all of my baking that I couldn't consume myself. And it was in London. I moved to London, lived in a shared house that was sort of on a passageway with lots of footfall because it connected a lot of roads and schools. And so I just put a kind of like in the countryside where you have eggs outside, you know, and it just says take some eggs and put some money in the jar. And that, but with cakes, was where I started. And I put it out every weekend, and it always just got emptied, and all the little pound coins in the jar. It was very heartwarming. So I kept doing that until cafes heard about that and asked if they would be able to get the cakes for themselves. So it kind of grew very organically from very, very humble beginnings.
That's really lovely that you ended up getting interest directly from that. You know, it must have been quite an ego boost to have the, you know, instead of just people going, oh, thank you for a cake, to have people approach and say, can we please stock your cakes? That's wonderful.
It was really nice. And I think because people don't trust London, they're kind of like the big city, they don't think that a countryside idea would work. So I think that's why people found it quite exciting, because people were really honest and it rarely got raided.
I was going to ask, how did people, like, did people regularly actually put in the requisite money, or were there days when you put out a whole bunch of things and they just evaporated? And
yes, sometimes. I think it happened twice, and I did it for about 3 years every weekend.
Oh my word.
So really not a bad record.
And amazing record. You got a, like, an IOU note once, didn't you?
Yes. People got very angry when the honesty box was not out. So if I went away or had a life in any way.
We actually had an honesty box on the farm as well. My auntie is a prolific baker as well. And during COVID, she set up an honesty box because there's a footpath that runs directly in front of our farmhouse. So it was called the Broom Cupboard, and it was full of chocolate nut bakes, and marmalades and jams and all sorts. And when it eventually stopped and she ran out of time and everything was going on, people for like 3 or 4 months after were like, when's the Broom Cupboard coming back? When's it coming? Mm-hmm. It's like, mate, like, it's just an honesty box.
I'm pretty sad that you know, the sausage rolls and the cakes and all that sort of thing aren't in the Broom Cupboard. We're surrounded by exceptional puns at the moment. We've got the Broom Cupboard now, as well as everything else. It makes me feel bad, because, you know, when Fliss was talking about her book title and how clever of a pun it was, you know, my title journey was, well, I've written a drinker's guide to Perry. What should I call it?
And my blog. I mean, what am I doing? I suppose I'm reviewing cider, so maybe I should just call it. Actually, write cider drink.
I'm glad you mentioned the blog, actually, because it was Laura setting up a blog about baking that inspired me to start putting my thoughts on, in my case, whiskey, down online. So Laura is entirely to blame for the enormous amount of lost time over the last 9 years now.
Well, to blame for you, but to thank from the point of view of the world of cider, because without Adam, cider would be suffering. So Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're getting the Adam Wells deep lore here. Man, that's amazing.
Yeah. So it must be about 10 years now since Beaten by a Whisker, you know, the origin story, because it's 9 years in June since I started blogging, and you were definitely miles before me. So
yeah, but I was thinking at university when we met, I don't think I baked cakes.
No, I was trying to think about this earlier, because we'd have tea, and I remember having cake that you hadn't baked, but I don't remember.
Yeah, it was post uni hobby, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And were you always baking vegan, or when did that kind of, when did that part come into it?
That was halfway through when I was supplying cafes. One of my housemates was vegan and I was slowly turning vegan, but still cracking a million eggs every day. Despite being vegan. And then eventually I kind of told all of the cafes that all of the cakes would be vegan, but not to worry, because they would still be good.
Well, there's some amazing stuff out there now for it, because my housemate does a lot of vegan baking, and they use that, like, this kind of plant butter, and they made sort of croissant with them that were, I mean I was floored by how sort of well it functioned. You know, it was very functional, not just tasting good, but actually seemed to have the right consistency. Yeah. And all that kind of thing.
I'm really interested in like what the substitute, for instance, for like eggs and things are in baking.
Well, baking. We're going to come on to that, because apples.
Amazing. I'm jumping the gun. I'm going to stick with challenges, though, because obviously you've been running a bakery for 2 years, and because I think you started just before you came to my wedding, and you were sort of a few weeks in then in terms of the bakery being up and running, and, you know, it was already sort of such a full-on thing, and then I saw you the year after at the bakery, and, you know, it doesn't seem to have slowed down. So what has the experience of actually running the bakery been like?
I think... challenging, very challenging. But I wouldn't change it, because I do really, you have to appreciate every customer that comes in. And when you're really busy, it's challenging because we're really busy. And that's obviously something I'm very grateful for. But it is just very intensive and long days. You obviously have to sell, because the cakes and coffees are £3. You have to sell a hell of a lot of them to pay your rent, to pay the staff. So you do end up kind of, most things fall upon me at the end of the day. And I don't know. I mean, it's great, but it's very, very tiring. I can't remember the whole question. Was it just about the challenges?
Challenges generally, yeah. I mean, actually, one that I noticed, again, because I was going through your the bakery blog today, where you were talking about how you're dealing with food wastage and stuff, and I'd never considered that, like, a mental maths that I guess you have to do of what is the amount that I need to make to still have product throughout the day, but also to have sold out of it. Almost, yes. You know, on the dot of four.
Yes, that is such a big challenge. And everyone, because it's a vegan bakery, I think the staff are all really eco-conscious and honestly take it so to heart when we waste things. So it feels like a big responsibility, not just in terms of it making business sense, because obviously it's such a waste of money as well, but just we don't want to be a negative impact as a business as a whole. And like today, for example, we sold out way too early because it was a crazy sunny day. It's always busy when we're sunny in the when it's sunny in the morning. And we just regretted not having more because there was the potential for it. But then have it as a principle that we make too little rather than too much, because I know that a lot of the chain bakeries just put everything in the bin at the end of the day, and it's just terrible, really.
Yeah. Well, having done challenges, then we'll move on to something a little bit more positive and upbeat. So, I guess firstly, because we've touched on university a couple of times, obviously, your degree was in architecture, and it's really unsurprising when you look at the eye for design, both in the bakery, but also on the Instagram. It's just absolutely beautiful. And you did most of the design of the interior of the bakery yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, I think it was the most fun part of architecture, sort of in a little bakery space, because it was just quite creative. We don't have any sort of ventilation or any of the practical things, so it's very much a space designed by an architect who didn't finish her training.
All these weird cantilevered floors.
It's probably better than designed by an architect who didn't start their training.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, that's just a pile of wood, I guess.
that's just you and I shouting, hey, you know what would be great if we built here? Jumping into baking more specifically, the cider connection that I found on the website today is that there was an article about sourdough starters, which is something I know literally nothing about other than liking sourdough, and that they involve something called a starter, which I had previously never looked up whatsoever. But it was really interesting seeing the... the points made by your bread mentor, whose name I've forgotten.
Hey, yeah.
The way he was talking was very wild fermentation versus pitched yeast, which is a very, very familiar discussion within cider. So I really enjoyed that parallel.
I don't know anything about it within cider, but yes, it is a kind of divide in the bread making world. So can you get the yeast naturally from the air to make cider?
Pretty much. It basically functions in the same way as your starter, except with the starter, you're using that as iron standard. You're going to have more consistency in your fermentation in the bread, right? Because it's all coming, all of your yeast is coming from the same source. With us, all the cider that I make is wild fermented. And there's a bit of a myth. People always, when they say, our cider's wild fermented, the yeast coming from the apples. It's true that there's yeast on the skin of the apples, but most cider makers, if you're making it in the same place every year, the yeast are the strains that have, they enjoy living in your pressing environment. So they're the yeast that live in our barn. And we don't do anything to take care of them. We don't have to feed them scraps of apple pomace like you do with your flour, but they are there year on year. So every cider maker that's using wild ferment has a consistency of flavor that's unique to them, the same as with everybody's personal sourdough starter, gives them something a little bit unique as well. It's very, very, a lot of connections that are similar principles.
That's really cool. So if you ever upscaled and changed location for some reason, you'd have to be really aware of the impact that would have on the taste.
Absolutely right. Yeah, it's the same as what dairy makers have found, right? When they've built brand new facilities and suddenly their cheese doesn't taste the same. For us, where we make the cider has slowly moved over the period of 30 years. And so it's kind of moved from originally a shed that isn't there anymore that was right next to the farmhouse. Then it went into the middle barn and now it's in the top barn. So it hasn't jumped too far, I think. But we're very much making cider in on a farm. It's farmhouse cider still. So our barns aren't sterile. The wind comes in through there with the rain and everything. And they're very old barns. They're 60, 70 years old. So there's lots of places for the yeast to live happily. And on our equipment, we clean everything at the end of the day, but we don't have to sterilize it because we're fermenting. So we're letting... Or, you know, it's just inescapable, basically. There's yeast everywhere, and that yeast is traveling through our entire process and jumping into the juice and fermenting the cider that we're making.
Yeah, I'm always, I feel like the starters, we have them in our, at one point, very temperamental fridges, and they were a source of much anxiety for me because I just thought, I mean, this is literally our bakery in a bowl, and if it dies... then everything will change. At one point, Teo, who taught me to make bread, and they're his starters, and they're 18 years old, I think, now, and they've been around the world being fed all different sorts of starter flowers. And he kind of bestowed them upon me in a kind of important way. And then I always was safe in the knowledge that he had some too. But then he's now stopped baking temporarily and he is relying on my starters.
Oof, that's a big responsibility, isn't it?
So yeah, I do feel pressure, but also they're very resilient. And we started giving away starter. At Christmas time, we put together like a starter kit with our starter and the proving basket and things like that so people could have a go. And people, I honestly thought... I don't know how much success people will have, but it will be nice for them to try. But ever since, people have come back and said they're baking amazing bread. So I think our starter is quite foolproof.
Yeah, that's really cool that people, you were able to do that starter kit and people taking it home, because it's what everyone started doing during lockdown, right? And then everyone ran out of time for it. So it's nice to bring that back and get people reconnecting. I made a starter during lockdown where I used the lees from our bottles, because we do a in-bottle fermentation. So I used that to... start my starter, but I can't make bread, so I was just making naan breads with it. So what's the point to say?
I mean, I was one of the many lockdown starter people. Unfortunately, I went home at some point just before one of the lockdowns, and then there was another lockdown, so I couldn't get back to London, and my starter ended up shut in a fridge for like 3 months, and it didn't die. It started moving under its own power, and my flatmates took an executive decision to bin it, which I was devastated about, because I just went through this period when I was just chain baking sourdough loaves, and I was absolutely mad for it, which is my only real experience of baking. I don't really make cakes or anything like that. I just got very, very into sourdough along with the rest of a lot of people during lockdown.
I love that, moving under its own power.
It was, they sent me a photograph. It was pretty grim. It was pretty grim.
Started to leave the fridge and kind of do chores and wander around the house.
I will clean the Dutch oven for you, Father.
Anyway, from that tenuous connection between baking and drinks, so when we were talking about wanting to do kind of a food and drink or a food and cider thing, and we were thinking about, you know, who'd be great on to great to have on to speak to, you know, I started thinking about like drinks in baking, and I thought, well, how much actually is there? And then I kind of realized that there are a bunch of glazes and things that you know, and then from that I kind of went down a rabbit hole. I know there's lots of tea. Sometimes that can get used, but Laura, can you tell us about drinks within baking generally?
So, are you talking about drinks, not alcoholic drinks, even
just any drinks? Any drinks?
Well, coffee cake, my favorite cake, is a good one. I hadn't thought of that one until you mentioned tea. Yeah, tea loaf is a really ancient recipe that I've never actually made, but I know Josh's grandma gave me a tea loaf recipe that was the only recipe that was vegan in her repertoire. So I think that's a good one. Yeah, glazes, and there's quite a lot of alcohol in mincemeat for mince pies, obviously soaking amaretto or couleur in tiramisu, but often they're not then baked again, I guess, when you do make a trifle or with sherry or tiramisu, it's not baked off. So that's a different angle. Apart from that, though, coincidentally, I think specifically I use drinks in maybe vegan baking or maybe just a weird quirk of my cakes. But because the Guinness cake that I make was one of the most successful textures of loaf cake, I decided to adapt that using a variety of fizzy drinks. It uses the bubbles in Guinness to kind of boost the baking powder or raising agent. And so I thought, bubbles equal good texture. What other bubbles are there? So that was quite a good link to drinks that I used in the recipes as well.
Have you found a successful sort of bubble? Because I mean, I guess we could go incredibly granular here and compare the kind of Guinness style bubble to like if you used champagne or if you used like, I don't know, Coke or something like that.
And all the different... Just stick a bunch of dough in a soda stream and go mad.
I mean, you laugh, it might work. I don't know.
That's the best thing, where I come up with something stupid and they're like, no, that's a real thing. That's a real thing, Justin. I'm just violently ignorant about all methods of production.
you're not being stupid. You're just miles behind the times.
Yeah, I'm stuck in 1809 in baking world.
Well, on drinks and baking, obviously, that brings us to the main thing, which is that we've sent Laura a couple of ciders and perries to create bakes with. So we're not going to do the same thing as you did with Fliss and make you two guess what they were. But we'll start with this. Which would you prefer to start with, Laura?
Well, I'm not going to do a very good job of describing them themselves because I haven't got the bottles with me. But I do know that they were very delicious. I did drink some of them to test. But maybe you should describe them. But we'll describe the first one and then I'll say what I did with it because I won't do it justice.
Fair enough. So the first one, we'll start with a Perry, actually. So that was from Artist Draw. It was their recent Ailey Perry from, I believe, an unidentified variety. And they showcased that at Perry Day in Applefest at Herefordshire back in October, was it? Yeah. Anyway, made from, it was really, really delicious. And those trees, sadly, are dying, but Artist Draw have taken some graft wood from it. So hopefully they will kind of restore that variety in their own orchard, which is really cool. So even though we don't know what variety it is, it's a really lovely, fruity kind of off-dry, I think it's still, I can't remember. So maybe, you know, useless for the gint for the purposes of...
It wasn't still.
Oh, was it not? Oh, well, fair enough. Then perfect. Exactly. As we've now discovered, the sparkling drink. So it's the route to we're off to a good start. So tell us what you did with that one, Laura.
Yeah, so that's key because I did swap the ciders after we spoke about which ones you were sending to me. I swapped the ideas around because of the ice cider being still, which was the more stronger, more liquor-y taste.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I planned to use in a apple and ginger cake, which was like an adaptation that I would normally use ginger beer in. Fizzy. Mm-hmm. And so when that one was actually still, I used the perry for the apple and ginger cake, but I made it a plain pear cake because I didn't want to add the ginger, because it was a more delicate flavor. Yeah, it was like a loaf cake and it used the bubbles to make it quite airy and spongy with pieces of pear running through the cake. And it was kind of quite like I used golden syrup as the sugar because I think that kind of enhances the flavors of pear. Mm. And yeah, left out the ginger so that it wasn't overwhelmed by that strong taste. And it was successful.
That sounds amazing. Fantastic.
I do have some pictures. I don't know if you have any way to put those.
Yeah. If you send us some pictures, we'll absolutely use them in the notes. And when we put all this on socials, that'd be incredible.
Yeah, plaster them all over Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah.
It's very hard to describe a cake, I find.
Fair.
I like what you said there, Laura, just the idea to use golden syrup as that and that mimicking the flavours of pear better or complementing the flavours of pear better. That sounds... it makes so much sense when you said it like that, and I think that's a really interesting angle to use a different source of sugar for it. I like that a lot.
No, I was going to mention that you said like there was a lot of use of ciders in patisserie and kind of more refined baking, but that's not really the style I'm an expert in. I'm not a classically trained pastry chef, so I thought I'd stick to kind of humble, good, honest bakes. I guess simple yet like showcasing the flavors was what I was going for.
Sounds amazing. And what I was going to say is that so many perries, and especially perries that do still have some of their residual sweetness in, are, you know, they kind of have an almost like, you know, floral honeyed kind of, so, you know, some of the rich ones kind of go in that golden syrup direction as well. So that sounds so incredibly complimentary. I want to try an artisan perry cake now.
Me too.
we shouldn't have done this online. We should have met up so we could all eat these cakes. This was also the blunder we made when we did something with Fliss.
Wait until you find out, Adam, that there are people listening to this whilst they drive their car thinking, why am I listening to these four people talk about food when I can't be eating any of it?
Well, with the driving, alcohol as well.
They'll say, well, I've got my bottle of artist straw now. I just don't have a cake.
I mean, I'm 3 750s deep, but it's the food I want.
I'd really soak up some of these M6 bottles. No, don't do that if you're listening.
I'm not sure at what point a bakery does need an alcohol license. Because I do not have.
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Do you find, I don't really know much about baking at all. Presumably if you cook it, then that's going to like cook off the alcohol. But do you tend to do, if you're like, I guess, steeping fruit or something, does that like get retained? Like how boozy do your cakes get?
I just work on the basis that they all burn off and therefore safe for children.
I think that's reasonable. Yeah. That's what
I don't know how you test it. I mean, I don't know if there are measurers. I guess you know.
No, I can't imagine how you test it at all.
Yeah, just shoving a bunch of cake into a gravitometer or whatever it is.
A gravitometer.
Either that or you find one of these kids to do a kind of Bruce Bogtrotter situation, eating the entire cake, and then you breathalyze them afterwards. Which we're also not advocating that, along with the 750s on the motorway. No, none of these things are endorsed by Cider Voice.
Cider Voice. No, yeah, never mind. Moving on very quickly.
It's all right. It was going towards a great joke, and it's going to be filed as such, I'm sure. What was your other? Sorry, I should introduce the other cider. So, yeah, as Laura mentioned earlier, what we also have is an ice cider, and this is from Borough Hill, who are also the Somerset Cider Brandy Company. They're one of the earlier people in the UK to do an ice cider, I think. But theirs doesn't list the apples. I know they love Kingston Black, but I don't know what the apple breakdown for this one is. But they've certainly aged it in a barrel for a little while that I presume has previously contained their apple brandy. So it's an oak age. It's really luscious, really dark, rich. I love it, but I haven't had it in a depressingly long time. Laura, you were going to use it in apple and ginger cake, but you changed.
Yes, because I didn't know it was still, although I should have presumed that from your description. I don't know. But this one, yeah, it was so, so delicious. I had no idea anything like this was being made, really. And when I sampled it, it kind of, yeah, it said it was used in cocktails and more as a spirit. And so I thought it had the potential to be kind of soaked. So I should tell you the story of the day. The day I was testing this was Thursday, and we used the bread instead of focaccia for sandwiches, and we have loads of offcuts at the end of the day, and then we have to find some inventive way not to waste them. So we're either making breadcrumbs to use in sausage rolls or something to make use. So I thought if I soak this leftover bread in the cider and layer it up and make a bread and butter pudding, but kind of with that apple-y taste. And when I took it out of the oven, it actually smelled so much like a quintessential apple pie, actually. Like, you know, that smell that is kind of the apple pie smell. And that was, the apple smell was just coming from the cider. So I soaked the bread, layered it up with some sultanas because I wanted it to have a Christmassy kind of, soaked fruit kind of vibe. And then we're also developing at the moment, we just got a Portuguese member of the team. And we're determined to launch vegan pastel de nata. So we have a lot of custard tests. And so I poured one of those over and baked it with some demerara sugar on the top to make kind of a twist on bread and butter pudding. Did I already say bread and butter pudding? That's the key information.
Yeah. That sounds incredible. Wow, yeah. That sounds fantastic. And like so different than what I had no particular expectations, but bread and butter pudding sounds incredible. And judging by the faces that Justin was pulling throughout that description, I think he's going to be trying that one.
Bread and butter pudding is one of those things that I forget how much I like it. It's like, I completely forget it exists. And then somebody, like, it turns up and I'm like, oh my God, yes. And then I go, like, I would absolutely demolish that. Especially the corner bits where it gets all like crispy and caramelized. We had a discussion a little while ago on one of the food episodes here about how I've to an extent aged out of my love of puddings. And I think that this one would drag me back, you know, just when I think I got out, they drag me back in. And it's a bread and butter pudding. I really want to try that, actually. I'd go mad on that.
I think it sounds great because it's an innovative way to use the cider in something. I think really letting it be the kind of core flavor in a bread and butter pudding through that is definitely a different angle, rather than, you know, just making like an apple pie, straight up apple pie, but putting some cider in it or something like that. So I'm really impressed.
That's really, really cool. I mean, like you say, Laura, I wanted to send you an ice cider because it is such a sort of, you know, as you say, decadent and rich. And, you know, I guess I envisaged it going, you know, into like a, well, because I'm unimaginative and don't know baking, I was thinking kind of like, you know, like that Christmassy thing that you mentioned, that it's kind of, you know, almost fruitcakey kind of vibes. But it's so cool that you, like Albert says, that you've made something where it's absolutely the star, and the you know, the bake is there to kind of guide the cider along almost.
It was really, really delicious, and I guess it's kind of satisfying that it was made just adding that to two products that would otherwise have gone to waste. Kind of, it was two things we had already made super delicious by the addition of one cider.
Brilliant. What a time to be alive. I think actually we've never actually mentioned, I don't think, ice cider really on the podcast before, so it's worth a quick aside to say what it is. So it's basically a way of concentrating the flavors and the sugars in an apple or in apple juice. And there's two ways that can happen. Either you get a tiny number of varieties that can hang on the tree long enough and grow in a cold enough climate, so mainly like Canada and a couple of places sometimes in North USA and maybe Sweden, where the apple will freeze, and the act of then unfreezing kind of desiccates the apple's flesh. So when you press it's being kind of biologically changed, and it gets this, there's less water in it because you remove some of the ice crystals. And you get this really kind of these luscious flavors. The other way is you press the apples as normal, and you leave the juice out, and it and the juice naturally freezes. We don't get temperatures really that are consistently cold enough like that in the UK. So generally, the people making ice cider in the UK will have induced the freezing process. So they'll naturally freeze the, they'll press the juice, freeze the juice, and allow it to thaw. Although I believe that Borrow Hill have experimented with leaving like barrels out, so smaller vessels out in really, really cold times. So I don't know exactly what they've done here, but I would assume it isn't like a natural cold freezing. But either way, you end up with this juice that is incredibly, it's incredibly high sugar and high flavor compared to like a normal juice. So it's got a really, really high specific gravity, and the yeasts, it's too much sugar for the yeast to kind of work through the whole thing. You can either arrest the yeast, but the point of it is to be a dessert cider. So it felt like a natural thing to send you as a something to go into baking. Although, I should also have thought that I hear baking and my brain just goes to cakes rather than to all the various sorts of savory baking. But anyway, that's the long-winded explanation for why you got an ice cider. But I'm really, really glad that it got put to such a exciting and cool use. So thank you very much for that. And now Justin and Albert have the unenviable job of following that act with some cider and curry related bakes of their own. Who would like to go first, chaps?
Well, first of all, I'm going to give a shout out to Little Pomona Cidery and Susanna Forbes. In during COVID, she connected with Neasy Bakery, which is a bakery in Hereford City that's just reopened. And they together launched the Hereford bun. So when I was growing up, my favourite pastry was a Chelsea bun by some margin, absolute classic. And the Hereford bun, Neasy soaked the currants in the Pomona cider, put apples in it as well as currants, and then it's glazed with a spiced cider glaze as well. So it's actually similar kind of ideas, right, to the bread and butter iced cider. And the Hereford bun, yeah, was super popular. I don't know if they're still making it because they were shut for a year and they've recently reopened, but hopefully they are and still connected with Little Pomona. So that was fun. And then, Adam and I, we were both away for 2 weeks, and then he got back, and this week he's like, oh, I hope you're ready with your bake. And I'm thinking, oh my Lord, what bake am I going to do? but luckily Adam was visiting me this weekend, so we could do some product testing. And in the same vein as Laura, I'm putting myself on the same pedestal of good, honest, simple baking. My bake is a pancake, which I experimented with substituting some of the milk in my pancake batter for cider. I used our oat cask brown snout, and it was quite remarkable. At first, it was a total disaster because it turns out if you use a simple 1-2-3 ratio for your pancake, and you change the milk from 100% milk to 50% milk, 50% cider, what you end up producing isn't a pancake, but it's some kind of, well, Adam, you can say exactly what you think.
I think we described it as a sort of tasty looking pancake squelch. It was crepe scramble, I suppose.
Honestly, it was baffling and quite unnerving watching it cook, thinking, hang on, this is meant to be a pancake and it looks like scrambled egg. And I was like, what?
How were the scrambled egg pancakes? Were they edible at all, or were they just unspeakable slop?
So, no, the first bit of slop was terrible, and I got rid of it. However, I then adjusted my recipe and added more milk back to the batter, and then I ended up needing to add more egg and flour to dilute the whole thing. But say something like 20% cider in there, that actually worked, and I had a really lovely crepe. And then when we were eating it, it was good. The brown snout was coming through very nicely. There was one final drawback, which is that in honor of the American professor who recommended adding salt to tea, I thought, okay, why didn't I try... Well, my initial idea was salted caramel pancakes, this kind of vibe. Because I've done a combo of toffee waffles with butt peri, and it takes all the tannin away, and it's lovely. And so I wanted to do that. But basically, I didn't know how much salt to add, and I added way too much. So these were incredibly salty pancakes. That did smell and give you the sensation of brown snout and that, you know, feeling of richness from that. But you ate it and you went, oh, that is a bit salty. But it was interesting stuff.
I think it did go really well with the butt peri, actually. And the cool thing about the brown snout was that it worked kind of with the maple syrup because it's got that rum cask thing, and brown snout is quite a naturally sort of dark, kind of rich flavor. But yeah, I mean, the first attempt, we said, and he came up, you know, on our podcast with Fliss, and his name's gone right out of my head. Oh, the guy who's like, oh, that's not very good, is it? Pardon?
Keith Floyd.
Yeah, it was a bit of a Keith Floyd moment of, well, that hasn't worked at all. But he put it right. And then also repeated it with a different cider this morning, and I thought it was fine, but it split the audience.
Yeah, we tried it again, but I chose to use bird bark instead of brown snout. And I had this same thing that Laura was talking about, because bird bark is much fizzier cider. It's actually our only force carbonated cider. And that does weird things to batter. And it's really useful when I cooked a tempura of vegetables at the pub in October, and I used a highly sparkling cider for that. That was obviously great. But in pancake batter, it was a bit weird and made it a bit harder to cook. So bird bark are not as good, and the depth of the cider not quite the same as the brown snout. So it was harder to get the ratio of everything I wanted with bird bark. But yeah, Adam still enjoyed it. They were more edible. They just tasted more like normal pancakes. I think the making them with a really rich cider, like a Keith cider, would also be a fantastic way to do it, because then you're adding some sugar to your pancake as well.
Well, on the subject of that and kind of Keith's taking you down to France, when I was in Brittany a little while ago, ages ago, on holiday, and had a whole bunch of crepes, including a bunch of savory ones. And like with you describing like the idea of having like the brown snout in that, like having a savory crepe that had like cheese or andouille sausage, is that it? The kind of very piggy sausage you get there. But like the idea of having like those kind of cidery pancakes or crepes and then doing a savory filling, I think could be quite an interesting vibe there, because as we all know, you know, these are harmonious flavors together, you know, cheese or pork or some things in cider. Justin's hot take.
Well, before we get Justin's hot bake, it's made me wonder whether there were ever like... Oh, Shrove Tuesday's coming up now, isn't it? Is there a Beaten by a Whisker pancake day on the cards? Especially now you've got this new hot tip on brown snout and bird bark.
Yeah, I mean, it could be good, but do you not feel like pancakes should be really hot and multiple rather than bought out? I don't know. There's something about pancake day that I used to enjoy as a child, which is, how many pancakes am I going to get to eat? And on.
I didn't enjoy that. I was in constant fear, thinking I need at least six, and if there's not six, I'm going to be really underwhelmed.
Yeah, and you think, how many is this going to make? And I just feel like the idea of kind of packaging them and serving them and them being taken out of your control is sort of losing the magic for me. I think
chaos is a key ingredient in pancakes. For a long time, there was a stain on our wall where my dad had flipped enthusiastically. what would be your pancake topping of choice? I was very conventional with my pancakes. I was always just lemon and sugar.
Yeah.
Albert's got me around to maple syrup now, but I'm still, I think, a lemon and sugar at heart.
Lemon and sugar, and kind of as much covert sugar as you can get on. And then a little bit on top as well once you've rolled it, pretending you didn't put that much inside, even though you did.
Justin, what about you? What's your pancake? And then what have you brought?
Pancake topping, I'm a lemon and sugar man. My bake, actually, it's funny, when you mentioned tea cake, Laura, my eyes lit up because that's what I had in mind. I sort of looked up a tea cake recipe online and saw that it was like that you steep the fruit and then you mix it in the batter and then you cook. And the reason I went to tea cake was thinking, well, a lot of the ciders I like, not all of them, but a lot of them have a fairly assertive tannin component. That's been part of, as I've talked about before, part of my cider journey is drifting towards tannin. And I was thinking, well, tannin and baking, I know that tannin can sometimes be hard to work with in cooking, but then tea can have tannin, especially if it's heavily brewed. So I wondered, well, could I do like substituting a moderately tannic cider for tea and steeping currants and sultanas in, I mean, part of my head went to Kingston Black because of the idea of introducing maybe some slightly tropical flavors. But I was also thinking that Major could be a good one because it's got that kind of like not quite as rich as Dabernet, but it's got some slightly savory vibes. So steep the fruit in that, then make your tea cake. And then if you serve that with like, it's not vegan, but like salted butter, because then, you know, you've got those tannins and the proteins and the salt and the sweetness working together to make a kind of total package. So that was the idea for my bake.
But you didn't actually make it.
Definitely didn't forget that I had to come up with this until this morning. That certainly didn't happen.
Well, I think you are now obliged to make it. And you've got plenty of time before we have to put all of this up so that we can have a photo to share with our probably 13 or 14 readers now that most of America tunes in to Cider Boys.
Well, doing this episode has made me actually quite excited to do that, as it always does with food. I actually had a very pleasant realization recently where just this is completely off piece, but I'm going to say it anyway because it is relevant, that I had COVID in September and briefly lost my sense of smell and taste. And recently I've realized that since I have regained full function of my sense of smell and taste, because I've started smelling incidental smells around me again. So in celebration of that, I'm full of enthusiasm for food and drink and things like that. So maybe I will turn my hand towards making my not tea, but cider cake.
After all, why shouldn't I?
Why shouldn't I? After all, why not? Why shouldn't I?
You could also celebrate regaining your senses by going to Beaten by a Whisker, since you live in London. Where
indeed, this is. I'll make the pilgrimage up to Walthamstow. It's a shame. I used to live not far from Walthamstow when I was at drama school. I was up in Turnpike Lane and Wood Green, and so it was just a hop, skip, and a jump. It would have been a hop, skip, and a jump, but sadly, I moved away from there many moons ago, and now I'm completely the other end of the city. But I will make the pilgrimage because I like the Walthamstow wetlands and things like that. It's a good place to go.
Make sure you give me warning when you're coming, so I can save you something. Otherwise, I don't need a pilgrimage, and then we've sold out cinnamon buns.
I'll make sure to come at like 4 p.m. and then get really pissy. No, absolutely, that'd be lovely. That was very kind of you.
I had the cinnamon bun when I was there last. Actually, I love like the knot shape.
It's actually become quite widespread, I think, that shape. I don't know if I've just been super alerted to it. But it's like a traditional Swedish knotting method. I think it creates a good texture, like outside to inside contrast.
Cool. I'd never really considered that as, it's one of those things that is sort of implicit to the consumption of it. But I, again, not being somebody who makes them, I'd never really thought about it. I'd never really thought about knotting as being anything other than just it looks quite pretty, rather than actually having meaningful kind of structural impact on how it's cooking and the texture and where you're going to get the gooey bits and where you're going to get the crispy bits.
But don't you save the middle, very middle of, say, a traditional swirl? The middle bit.
I'm a weirdo, and I save the edge because I like the crispy bit. I try to save like a bit of edge that also has a little bit of bit of squodge as well. But I'm primarily a chewy person.
How do you do that? Do you like poke the middle bit out and consume that first?
Yeah, I fold it in half and then eat it like a calzone.
Sorry, Albert, we completely jumped on the fact that you had a serious question.
No, well, it wasn't a serious question. I was merely going to compliment Laura on the social media that you have and the incredible high quality of all of the photography of all of the stuff. I mean, the bakes look beautiful. So, and I was going to say to people that if you aren't in London or you aren't in Walthamstow and you can't go out as soon as you hear this to try it, then you should head to the Beaten by Whisker Instagram and just go into food fantasy heaven, because it's just it's amazing. And I basically wanted to ask if it's if the photography is done in-house, if that's your skill or one of your staff, or how much you've invested in it, because I mean, it is seriously good photography.
Oh, thank you, that's so kind. I mean, it is all done in-house. I think we have the benefit, just to just deflect the compliment, I think the light is amazing, so basically anything works really well in the space. And actually, a lot of photographers, because it's very rare that a kitchen space is not in the basement of a restaurant or just devoid of natural light. And our space is quite cool because it has a big facade that is entirely windows, and it's a totally open kitchen. Yeah, so yeah. Really nice light for photography. I think has benefited the Instagram. And then I did do some photography back in my previous life where I wasn't a baker, but I did like online e-commerce work. But I would say, yeah, I just really enjoy making the Instagram look really beautiful. So that's like a little thing that I do on the side, like a little creative project.
Yeah, I love it. No, it's really beautiful.
I just logged onto it on my phone just now, and I am, as Albert said, going into rhapsodies over this. I mean, especially every single shot of like the structure, like of the bread slices. I'm like, oh yeah, oh look at that, gore, look at that.
No, I'm not surprised that the Instagram is as beautiful as it is, because I mean, I knew that you were a baker. Obviously, your degree is architecture, but you know, I always knew you as an artist, and I've been the beneficiary of that because I have co-opted Laura into drawing numerous posters for me for various plays that I've done, both at university and since. But no, I mean, it is a stunningly beautiful Instagram page. When I visited for the first time, shamefully late, about a year after you'd opened, I sent Albert and Justin pictures of the bakery, and Albert messaged back pretty quickly talking about how beautiful he thought the Instagram was.
Well, thank you. I do not like social media that much, but I find with food, because you're consuming it, and it's just kind of, what do you call it? Transient, is that the word? It's really nice to have like a permanent record of what you've done and like what you made over the seasons, and to look back at last, I don't know, month, previous year, and remember the kind of seasonal bakes that you were making then. And yeah, just record it in a visual way is very satisfying. So for that aspect, I do really enjoy social media, but it's definitely not my goal to sort of grow and grow my following in an online-y way, because I'd far rather be in the kitchen.
Well, I did have another kind of game to potentially play, but I think we'd end up running on and on and on. I don't want to leave on a weak note after that.
How good a game is it, Adam?
Well, it was going to tie into the fact that everything at Beaten by Whisker is plant-based, and we have probably underserved our vegan listeners, to be honest, because whenever we do a food pairing recommendation, it's, I would simply take this meat and then cook it in three different ways, add a bit more meat, and that'll be amazing with brown snout. So I was going to suggest, and especially since... Laura, we've discussed doing a cider kind of supper club at some point. So to kind of whet our appetites for that, I was going to get you and Albert, Justin, to come up with one plant-based dish. It doesn't have to be baked, and we will come up with a cider to go with it. And then, Laura, if you could maybe pick a savoury dish or sandwich that you currently sell at the bakery, we will put our minds to a cider to pair with that. So, Does anyone wish to kick off if we go ahead with this fantastic dish?
Don't forget, Adam, that I have served an entirely vegan dinner, supper club already, at the pub. So I've got all this ready to go.
Well, then go for it. Please, kick us off.
Please help me. Save me.
Well, the
Justin's like, I haven't eaten anything that wasn't meat for 12 years.
I actually cook quite a lot of vegan food, but it's just not vegan. It's largely just like oil-based pasta sauces and stuff like that. But
I was going to say not... spoilers. I have my thing in my head, and it's going to be very, very simple. But I think if it's a pleasing dish that you love, it can be a... but I'm calling Bagsy on pasta right now.
How dare you? I can't believe you've done this.
Anyway, Albert, please hit us with your vegan dish and cider and peri pairing.
Okay, well, I'll go with the starter, because I think that was actually the drinks pairing that really worked the most. So basically it was tempura vegetables, and we had like aubergine, I think we had sweet potato. I can't remember the other two. We had four. Butternut squash as well as one of them. Served under a bed of Nepalese chili sauce, which is really lovely, sweet, sticky, quite hot, but not powerful sauce with good depth that I got from Santosh Shah, who's a fantastic, beautiful chef. And then we had that, and it's just vegetables with a chili sauce, and then we served that with Greenhorse Peri, which is lovely, floral, light, and very fresh peri. So for me, I felt that it was really enjoyable drinking it, because you had something that was so much umami in the tempura vegetables that then the peri just lifts what you're having, right? And you've got the airiness and the crispiness of a tempura batter on them as well. I really loved that whole pairing. I basically, like, the rest of the dinner was great as well, but I could have eaten, you know, three persons worth of those vegetables with that peri. No problem.
That's a good start. Justin, over to you.
I'm going to go slightly off the brief and do something that could be paired with a cider, but could also have cider mixed into it. I'm sort of frantically responding to the brief, and going back to type of things I've been having a lot recently, which is, again, Mexican food, homemade. And I wondered about something like black bean empanadas. And then I wondered about frying or like not quite dry frying or sauteing or something, but like sticking the kind of black bean sort of puree stuff, putting in a slug of a relatively acidic cider, cooking that off to get that through, and then putting that in the empanada, and then having sort of, so you get that sort of the umami and the kind of richness of the beans, but then you've got a little bit of that acid and the fruitiness cutting through. I mean, the when I say acid, I'm going to go back to my old standby of Foxwell, which is just what I say whenever I'm put on the spot about cider. But I'm sure that there's plenty of others. You could use like Browns or again, like Kingston Black, like earlier. Yeah, I think I'd defend that as an option.
Yeah, that sounds great. That was a great call. Well, I was going to be... Yeah, that sounds amazing. Top mark. I was going to be... I don't think it's lazy, because I love it. And actually, when we were doing our episode with Fliss, I mentioned that I just, for the first time, cooked that really simple pasta dish that's just, you know, garlic and olive oil. And I love it. And it, yeah, you know, it, and any sort of, like, light and fresh and ideally like with a bit of acidity kind of cider or peri goes super well with it, and I keep thinking about it and wanting to make it again loads. So that's like a bit of a cheat option, because it's just three ingredients. But also we're really lucky where in Reading we have some like amazing different restaurants of cuisines from all around the world, and lots of them contain like quite high levels of spice, and something that we should probably discuss in greater detail in a future food episode is that I think cider and peri pair much better with food that has quite a lot of spice in than, for instance, wine does, because spice and alcohol don't really like each other so much. So the fact that cider and perry are lower alcohol but still have all that fruit, it really, really works in their favour. Anyway, there are some places around me, particularly a place that actually we just went to tonight, that do absolutely fantastic dials. And, you know, I was just thinking that kind of, you know, the richness and, you know, depth of the, you know, of the lentils and the and so on, and the kind of earthiness of the spice, I think would pair fantastically with a sort of bittersweet, bitter sharp blend. It's, you know, it's kind of, you want something somewhere in the middle. And just because I saw it on the bar yesterday, so it's in my head. Albert has a keg conditioned blend that's kind of a go to, which is Somerset Red Streak Major and a little bit of Foxwell, in you know, not quite equal proportions, I don't think. But anyway, that it, you know, I've often kind of felt of that as kind of the perfect pub cider, in that it's not too much in any direction. It's not like a cider of extremes. It's just got loads and loads of flavor with a bit of tannin, a bit of acidity. It's kind of, you know, a perfect archetypal dry cider, and that for me, I think, would go incredibly well with something like a really rich dahl. So that's my contribution to cider and food pairing from a plant-based point of view. So loads of ideas for supper club there, Laura. But if you could give us an example of something plant based that you'd like us to recommend a cider and perry pairing for.
Yeah. So we don't really do like sort of substitute meats or anything, or kind of processed, meats and cheeses and things. But we do a vegan sausage roll, which is made of kind of mushroom and onion and herbs and leftover breadcrumbs, which is one of our most quick to sell out things. But I feel like if I give you that one, you've got an immediate go-to that you mentioned goes really well with pork already. So I'm going to give you a difficult one instead. So there's a sandwich along the same lines. It's kind of taking inspiration from the meat and fish world, but not trying too hard to completely replicate. But there's like a smoked rapeseed oil from Duchess Farm that when I opened it, it immediately reminded of smoked mackerel pate. So we use it in a sandwich, which is kind of sliced up artichoke hearts mixed in with a cashew-based mayonnaise cream with this smoked oil. And we serve it with like a radish and rocket salad and pickled cucumbers in a focaccia sandwich. So it's kind of got smoked mackerel pate vibes, but veganized. I don't know if there's any cider that would pair with that. I wouldn't know. That's interesting.
I mean, that sounds banging. I'd almost be tempted to go for a perry with that, with the kind of bright, clean, fresh, zingy flavors. I don't know. I mean, maybe Green Horse, something like that. But that seems to be like bright, green, fresh, you know, analogous to fish, little bit of smokiness. That sounds like an absolutely banging summer sandwich as well. Like real kind of like out for a walk in the park kind of vibes.
It sounds delicious, and I reckon that I sent Adam away with a bottle that is worth trying with this sandwich today. So we have a cider that's going to come out in a few months, which is Foxwhelp, which Laura's most beautifully intensely sharp and acidic, flavoursome strawberry and raspberry kind of characters in the cider. It's amazing. And this particular batch was fermented in previously a barrel that had been used for peated whiskey. So it's got lovely depth of flavour from the smokiness as well. And I'm imagining that if you have this with that sandwich, it's really going to help put you even closer to that smoked mackerel pate concept. Because the smoke is going to kind of merge with the sandwich, and it's going to help bring the drink and the food together. And then the acid is going to go there. And I almost wonder if you could take out the pickle for that pairing to work even better, because it's such a sharp cider that you wouldn't need those in there. But I don't know. It sounds like fun. And then since Adam has the bottle, next time he's in London, he should meet up with you. Prime. That's what I reckon.
Have to take Justin's idea of Green Horse as well, and we'll kind of come back in an episode in the future and say, well, actually, the winner of this game was. They sound incredible. I thought as soon as Laura said the word smoke Albert's going to enjoy this. Albert's going to have it. Yeah. Where are we going to go with this? Will it be something that will go with the raison d'etre? But yeah, absolutely. Once you'd sort of said the rest of it, the peated fox whelp sounds like it will be an absolute hit. And I think you're exactly right, Justin. Sounds such a wonderful summary kind of compilation's a really stupid word, but a better word is not.
I don't know what you mean. Yeah. Composition.
Brilliant. Well, then that concludes all of the games that I had. Laura, would you like to tell us actually if there's anything coming up that people should be really excited about with Beaten by a Whisker, or simply more of the same kind of winning celebrity endorsed baked goods?
Well, we've recently invested in a laminator and also a very high tech prover, so croissants are on the cards very soon.
Oh yeah.
Which I believe is the benchmark of a proper bakery. So, no pressure.
We have a vegan, well, a bakery near us that isn't vegan, but they do a vegan version of their croissant. So they have an amazing vegan almond croissant that is so good. Mm. So that's awesome that you're getting that going.
Yeah, there are some really good ones out there. I just hope, I don't want to launch them without doing it justice. But also, people are asking for croissant all the time, so something we've got to get going.
I mean, so, yeah, it's an excuse to endless quality control before launching. I have a large batch, but I really just wasn't sure, so I've eaten all 50 of them. maybe next week on the croissants.
I have done a lot of market research, probably more than was necessary.
I don't think you
don't say that.
Research on croissants.
Yeah, that's all really. I mean, yeah, January was Veganuary, so we had a little bit of that. But then, yeah, the year, we're coming up to our 2-year birthday, and I hope to have croissants by then. That's my target. So, yeah.
When is the 2-year birthday?
22nd of February.
22nd of February. Well, I'll see if I can swing by then.
Okay.
and get really angry if there aren't any croissants.
You're ranting and raving. I bought my bottle of Green Horse. I was going to buy a sandwich as well.
I drank most of it on the tube, you know.
Does anyone else have anything they wanted to plug before we wrap things up?
The only thing is that, A, if you're in the UK and you're a side professional or care about the side industry, you should strongly consider coming to CraftCon, which is April 5th and 6th. The website is craftcon.co.uk, organised by the Free County Cider and Perrier Association, of which by the time this airs, I will be the chair. So people should definitely come to CraftCon. And that people should get in touch with the podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, if you are going to try any of the foods or recipes that have been talked about, then let us know either on social media or by emailing the podcast with the information in the show notes.
Amazing. Yeah. Justin?
Yeah, I've nothing particular. I just, email, Instagram message, your thoughts, your dreams, any ideas. Please don't send hate mail, but otherwise, you know, let your heart flow open and free, and we'll not reply to it for weeks.
Fantastic. And I'm just going to add, because we haven't for ages, a thank you to Drew Flanagan, who is continuing to let us use his music for our intro and outro. But that aside, thanks so much for coming on, Laura. This has been amazing and such a brilliant chat. I keep wondering, you know, how can we kind of make these food and cider podcasts different each time? But this has been fantastic and totally different to anything we've done before. So thank you.
Oh, it's been so good to chat to you. Thank you.
Great. Well, best of luck for the second birthday and the rest of the year. And I will see you two, Albert and Justin, on the next one. And thanks very much to everyone who's listened wherever you are.
Bye-bye.
Bye.